Right, well, are you actually recording now?
Yeah.
All right. Well, as I think my first experiences with paganism were quite young, although not the paganism we know of it as today. I was brought up by my granny, and my granny was a great one for telling stories, you know, folk tales, and I was brought up with all these kind of traditional folk tales and stories, and spent a lot of time in company of really old people. And I guess that sort of got me into having a respect for tradition, mm-hmm. for the way elderly people looked at things, and even some things and expressions that, you know, couldn't really be explained to me, why people did certain things. And I know that as a four-year-old, my grandmother used to lay out the dead in the village, in the days before the undertakers.
Yeah.
And as a four-year-old, I can remember getting taken to lay a woman out. And I guess if you get used to this kind of thing at such a young age, firstly, the current modern idea that, you know, sort of death is a very taboo thing, mm. was not really part of my upbringing, because death in a very real sense was part of life and very much accepted as such by my grandmother, because obviously if your calling is to lay out the dead, it becomes so. You know, plus also I did live in a very small village in Lancashire, which in those days was becoming bigger. It's now just part of sort of Manchester, sort of people who go into Manchester to work now, right. You know, but in those days it was a very sort of separate and independent kind of a community, with considerable differences to a lot of the area around it, bordering on Cheshire. Apparently the difference between our community and many others was that where a lot of Lancashire has cotton mills, there was a vast amount until a very late date of home weaving done, and very specialist weaving for the silk trade. I mean, my great grandmother used to weave at home. She was one of these special weavers. Mm. And I don't know why it had developed in this way, but most of the people were not employed in. They were employed in the kind of silk trade. You can't mechanise, or you couldn't mechanise it in a way that it was done in the Industrial Revolution. So it was sort of like a little bit of southern Lancashire that specialised in, probably due to its proximity to Liverpool, that specialised in, also it was something to do with the very damp conditions there in that particular part of the country, because it was very low-lying. Which suited the working of silk extremely well. And silk weaving has special rules and things with patterned, you know, sort of like patterned weaving.
Right.
And this stuff was so highly skilled that it was only in the sort of post-war period that they actually sort of could reproduce this kind of thing by machine. Mm. So it was actually a community that worked largely at home, and it was fairly agricultural and rather different to the bulk of Lancashire. As to why it had become that way, I don't know, but it was rather culturally separate from the rest of Lancashire. Indeed, I've actually found out that my family were actually recorded as actually living there from the 1500s, and that in Norman times my family were actually living about 25 miles away. So it wasn't surprising that when I went to primary school, we were in a very sort of inbred, closely knit community, which it certainly, it changed with the advent of, you know, cars becoming more common and sort of commuting into Manchester or Liverpool.
When was this? What sort of years was this? I don't know how old you are, actually.
I'm 48.
Right.
So I'm actually talking about early 60s.
Right.
My father moved from there in 66, probably. I was 12 then, so my memories are sort of like pre-12. Right, so to move on, my parents moved to Somerset in 1966 when I was 12, and my parents were Christians. My grandmother was not overtly Christian, and I've heard it mentioned that my grandfather didn't have a funeral service in church because he said, "I didn't go in the place in life, so I'm damned if I'm going to go in there when I'm dead." So they had to actually carry out the funeral service by the side of the grave because
right.
He refused. It was his specific wish that he should not enter the church. So whether this was actually due to him being an atheist or an agnostic, but he was definitely not. He never went in the church in life, so, and he wasn't going to go in death. It was a well-known anecdote. My grandmother was a very forward-thinking woman for her age. She was. She also had friends who'd been involved in some kind of. She was quite feminist. She was someone who was associated with the sort of like communist movement in the 30s. And I think she's what you described in those days as being a free thinker. And she certainly didn't tolerate fools gladly. And I don't believe she was a great. I don't believe she was really a practicing Christian. She had expressed certain views to me on Christianity, most of them fairly critical. She also had connections and contacts with people who were involved in this sort of like spiritualist thing that went on in the 30s. She certainly didn't. She certainly did have a belief in the afterlife, although her beliefs were very much her own rather than the standard ones that the church sort of dictated. My mother and father, however, because they were in the backlash, they were young kids, I suppose, during the Second World War. Now, if you look in terms of the way that nationalism and runes and Germanic myth was used in the Second World War. A lot of people, there was very much after the Second World War an upsurge in Christianity. A lot of that generation who were sort of like kids during the Second World War became very Christian. They today are the people who are like in their sort of late, well, 70s now, who are, you know, like what sort of. They're the mainstay of the Christian church, and what happens when they go, I think they're going to be a bit worried about it. And, you know, that generation was very much a kickback against the sort of Germanic myth idea.
Yeah.
And so my parents were sort of like very keen Christians. Now, because there is a great difference in the way that, in my opinion, there's a big difference between the way churches are in the north of England and the way they are in the southern England. In terms of the Church of England, you get in the north of England, you tend to get low church, which is more like Methodists and people of that nature, and they tend to do things with little ritual and all that kind of thing. And yet, in our village, there was a lot of Roman Catholics. I think there seemed to be quite a lot of people of Irish ancestry in the village, right, too. And yeah. But, so what happened was that, but down south in the West Country and south of England, they're very much more what you call high church. You understand that phrase?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which means they actually do a lot more ritual and more approaching the Roman Catholic thing. My parents sort of joined a church in where we moved to. And about a year later, we hit what for me was the big sticking problem. I was supposed to be going to classes for confirmation, and I hit the big problem to me, the problem of the original sin. Mm. Now, I was brought up by a feminist granny. You couldn't describe her as anything other than feminist. She was northern, blunt-spoken, and extremely, well, cynical, really. She was very, she had a very satirical sense of humour, my granny. And not everybody used to get the joke half the time, but if you're awake, you'd get it. And I went to a church where they were trying to tell me that I wasn't as good as a man just by virtue of the fact that I was a woman because of this doctrine of the original sin. Now, I thought, this can't be right. You know, if this God likes men better. Now, I'd lived in this small community in the village, and as I said, there was a lot of Irish people. And my experience as a kid was I'd seen women holding the community together. My aunt, she'd looked after her mother, her husband's mother. Her brother was a policeman whose wife died of cancer. And later on, he was killed in a policeman-type accident. And she'd looked after his two sons, her own children. She helped a friend who had a disabled son. And today she's over 80 and she's still looking after her grandchildren. Mm-hmm. You know? I look at women. As a kid, I looked at women like my auntie. And to me, she was like, she was a human being with bad tempers and what have you. But when I had Asian flu, she looked after me. The rest of my family were ill. Whenever my granny was ill, she'd look after me. Because my mother wasn't around a lot, because my mother was away from home because of work a lot of the time, which is why my granny looked after me. And the thing is, I looked at people like Auntie. I said, well, what I've learned about Christianity is like she was a total example to me of what Christians ought to be like. Mm. And yet, these people were coming to me and saying, well, she can't be that good because she's a woman. And I looked at people that I'd known in the village, you know, people who used to, where the men, some of the men, particularly the Irishmen, they used to, you know, go out and drink all the money, gamble all the money, and come home and beat their wives up. Now, these people are more accessible to God because they're men, because they're holy. Yeah, as a 13-year-old, it didn't add up to me. because of what I'd seen and experienced in life. Because my granny basically traipsed me around with her all the time, you know. I'd been sort of like a kid traipsed around and listened. You know, I've worked out if I sat still, I could listen to all this gossip, all this, you know, all this adult stuff. And it was much more interesting, really, you know. Because in those days, the telly was just sort of picture book and watch with mother, you know. And, you know, it was. I was just the little girl who sort of like sat in the background, because my granny was she was kind of a person that people came to with the problems. And, you know, I mean, I'd sort of like seen women come into her with roses and everything. And, you know, saying, well, he spent all the money, I've got no money, and he's beaten me up. And I was there, and, you know, I was sort of like looking up, kind of, you know, I could see all them bruises down her. And I went, you know, down to a much more middle class area, where, you know, people don't do this kind of thing. And it was like, you know, so they're trying to tell me that their God likes men better. Now, I was sent by my mother to sing in the choir, my mother and my father, and my mother used to play the organ. My mother was a professional musician, which is why she was away so much. And she used to play the organ voluntarily, not for money, just because she did it. And a big row erupted because apparently the then vicar didn't feel that women were fit to do this sort of thing. It ended up with my father getting in the news of the world for punching this organist who was 20 years his junior and about a foot taller, because my father's actually the same height as me, about sort of 5 foot two. Yeah? You know, small, bespectacled, 5 foot two guy knocks organist out on altar, you know. And I was told that I couldn't sing in the choir because they only wanted boys and men, because women were not considered fit to serve this God. And at 13, my parents left the church after the incident when my father knocked the organist out on the altar. And I used to sort of have this idea that I had to avoid the vicar's house on the way home because he was really sort of like something like the Antichrist, you know. Because, you know how you do when you're 13, you think, dare I really walk around his garden, you know, yeah. I mean, if he's that bad, you know. But seriously, at the age of 13, I was looking at all these questions about original sin in great depth, think this doesn't fit with the way I look at things. And my parents went to another church, but I lost Christianity at that point. I said, it doesn't coincide with what I feel like, it isn't me. It doesn't tie in with my experience, you know? I mean, it doesn't tie in with what I see, what I've experienced in my life. So, therefore, somebody's got something really severely wrong somewhere. And I never went back to the church, despite the fact that my father was a staunch church member to the end of his life. I mean, I did manage to talk to him later in life and explain my point of view as a pagan. And as my auntie said to me, she said, oh, you... Because he was like a lay reader and lay preacher type sort of person. Yeah. And I sort of talked to my aunt and I said, yeah, this is what I do, you know, I'm doing rituals, and we did a funeral the other week, and, you know, I do baby namings and other things like this. And she said, oh, you're just like your dad. No, she didn't say I was just like my dad, but she said my dad was a selfish man in his own way. And she said, well, you're just doing the same as he is. She was not in the slightest put out by the fact that I said I was a pagan. She said, well, it's just a slightly different way of doing it. No problem to me. All my relatives took it like that. I'm even talking about elderly people over 80. They were not surprised that I had gone the way I'd gone. Maybe they had a fairly pagan viewpoint anyway. But to go back to, right, so moving on, I just happened to be in the hippie era in Somerset. You know, so all the people from London decided the place to be in life was Somerset, and I was a school kid, you know, sort of like 1968, and half the people came down from, it became the trendy place to be, you know, oh, let's go down to the West Country and be by the seaside, oh, let's go up to Glastonbury and start doing, and I was vastly interested in history, and along the way, a friend of my parents had a son who introduced me to the Lord of the Rings when I was about 14. And that was a turning point in my life. Because it showed me how myth could be real and feel real and feel relevant. I'd always been interested in myths and folk tales, ancient history, and I continued to pursue a lot of local history stuff, and one of the things that happened to me when I was fairly young had influenced me considerably, and that was when I went to my aunt's once. My cousins were littler than me, so they went to in the afternoon, and one day I just went wandering about there where they lived. I found this little girl to play with. She had this string hanging from the tree. And we played for an hour or two, and played on the swing and talked. I didn't feel anything unusual about it. And I went, but my uncle over tea said, oh, what have you been doing today? I said, oh, I played with a little girl who lives in the big house across there. He said, there's no little girls there. I said, are you sure? I said, yeah, we played on the swing from the tree. And he thought. So we went across there, because it was summer. And he showed me the tree. Where the swing was, there was two bits of rope. He checked out when there had been kids. There was an old couple lived in the house. He checked out when there had been kids in that house. And the time when there had been a kid in that house. She was a kid who was evacuated from Liverpool during the war. And she was so lonely. She was so lonely and unhappy there. Because she was used to playing in back streets at Liverpool. And she couldn't cope living in a house out in the country. Though they made her a nice swing in there. And she was loved her street before. And eventually she went back to Liverpool. She was killed in a bombing raid in Liverpool. And that was during the war. And I'd been playing with her. My uncle was a fairly remarkable man in some ways, very unlike my father. My father was very fact, and when the past was gone, my father had a very much, strangely enough, scientific outlook, despite that he'd actually studied languages. And my uncle, who was actually a nuclear scientist, had a much more who had a much more certain view of the world, and my uncle knew that I had some abilities of which, well, while not being able to explain them, he perfectly accepted they were there. And I'd gone having a number of experiences. I took a neighbour's dog out one day. I felt we were walking up in this old place, and it was a wall. It was a knocked-down old place. It was right out in the woods, and the dog took a deep fright. This place felt damp, dark, and very horrible. And the dog took a deep fright, pulled the lead out of my hand, and 2 miles down the road, in sheer horror place. And I didn't like it either, but the dog wasn't on it, you know. And I thought, so I tried to go back up there again. The dog did the same thing. Dog anywhere near it. Dog. Dog. Dog is going anywhere near it. So I thought definitely something in this, even if it's only a dog. And as I say, in the 60s, people got more interested in sort of what you call earthly. You know, the sort of like the feeling presence of a place and the history of a place. Being in the West Country, I think I got involved in sort of like locality and the feelings of places. And I guess this was where I sort of came. I had a faith by this time that they're completely on the wrong track. That I had a faith that the ancients knew stuff. I didn't know, but I was going to damn well learn. You know, wherever I could find it. In local tales, local stories, wherever. Stuff there for me to find out. And, I suppose I'm in London, I travelled about a bit around the country, and as I was a new age traveller for the travellers, you know. And I came into people who celebrated the. They were very vague in those days, you know, they sort of like, you know, we celebrate summer solstice, winter solstice, you know, we do things differently. I met some people who were sort of like king goddess people. I thought, yeah, this is okay, but this isn't my way out. It wasn't really until I was a young... Eventually, I settled down in Scotland and had my kids. And it wasn't really until I started to... I'd done a lot of reading, a lot of finding out, a lot of things. Didn't feel personal experience of the land, my connection with the land, just within the land. This all started to fit in, and I started to. I mean, some days, I'd see the post, and it's really, really wet, the river would be isolated and cut off for maybe 3, 4, 5 days. And I was there, my husband worked away from home, and I was away from influence from society. I didn't have a television, I had a radio. Actually, I was away from society. I was there with my own kids, my animals, my resources, my earth, my weather, my sky, my river, my, you know, that was my world. And I became part of that place. That place became part of me. That was where I really began to know. I had few distractions, but I began to experience life as it would have been to our ancestors living on the land. In some ways, I mean, not completely obviously, but in some ways, it was like the river used to flood over into a twisty, windy river, and the whole valley was deep, and it was silting up. And when the rains or the snow melted from the hills by Bullock Pool, which was about 40 miles away, the water used to sweep down the rocky surfaces because hardly any soil to stop it. And it used to meet the incoming tide bang on the point just underneath us. And the whole thing used to go whoosh and flood. And it would stay a big lake. And there was no way in or out of where we lived at that time. And so there was, and some of the local people knew when it was going to flood. Nobody could predict when it was going to flood. And when my kids started at school, because my kids used to go to school in the village, which was 2 miles down the road, across this river, so obviously I had to know when it was going to go over. And I said to the teacher, I rang her up one day and I said, I'm not going to send the kids in today, Lily, because the river's going to go over. She said, but there's nothing of it. It's never going to go over at the moment. I said, By 3 o'clock, that river will be over. She said, oh, well, if you really think so, are you sure? She said, did Robbie tell you? I said, no, I have not seen Robbie. I haven't asked him. He was an old man who'd lived up there all his life. And he knew when it was going to go over. Yet nobody from the village could know. Some of them, yeah, maybe if it was coming up, say, yeah, it's going to be over in a couple of hours, but, like, you could go from being completely just calm little stream to, I mean, the guy 10 mile up the valley, who used to get his dead cows, he was an Englishman. He employed people, and he didn't listen to his workers. Mm. He'd say, no, it's fine. I want the cows down there grazing that grass. And the employees would say, river's going to come up, they'll get washed away. And they say, no, no, nonsense, man, you don't know what you're talking about. You know, the college-educated, middle-class Englishman trying to play at being a Scottish laird. And sure enough, river would come up, and you'd get the dead bodies of the cows, and you'd bring him up and say, hello, is that, the farm? And he'd say yes. I said, well, do you know you've got four dead cows down here that you're going to have to come and pick up? You know, and we used to get sick of doing it. Because the guy wouldn't take his workers' advice. Mm. Because he couldn't tell when it was going over. But he couldn't tell. But I said to her this day, well, it'll be over. And sure enough, 3 o'clock hit, the whole river was over. She said, well, how did you know? I said, well, I can't say how I know. It's just like you get to know the river like you get to know a friend, like you get to know someone you see every day, like you know... You get up in the morning, and you look at the sky, and you look at the clouds, you look at the mountains, and you get a feeling what the weather's going to be like. It's not a weather forecast on the telly. There was wrong in life. But it's like you get to know what the weather and the river and what messages that is telling you. You can start to read it in the same way that probably our ancestors could, but modern man has lost the ability to do. And she tried me out over a period, you know, and I said, well, look, I'll send them in when I feel it's okay. And sometimes I send them in when it's quite high, and she'd say, are you sure? Yeah, it's okay, it's going to go down now. And sometimes it'd come up and it wouldn't go over, flash flood, you know. Mm. And every time I was right. Now, it wasn't because I had some special knowledge or because I'd been brought up there. It's because I was there. I was working with the land. I was experiencing in a way. And this is where I got... This is when I became totally and absolutely convinced. Also, to do with other traditions and things I've found out, as many people up in the North Scotland are they're very much surface Christians, you know. They'll go to church every Sunday. On Monday, you'll see them out doing Gaelic rituals over the crops. And maybe on Friday, you'll see them going out sort of sprinkling their cattle with water and saying Gaelic words at them. And well, that's not religion, it's just tradition. It's what my grandfather did and his grandfather before him, you know. And they don't seem to see any conflict in it, in the same way that the Irish don't see any conflict between, you know, going to the church on a Sunday. Well, that's one thing you do. And the rest of the thing is, well, it's tradition, we do it, you know. They just don't seem to see any conflict between it. But to me, because I'd gone through all the experiences of seeing the conflict in the way I thought and the way the Christian church was, I was looking for ways out of it. And Who is fortunate in that? I was very happy to talk to some of the old people about some of the old traditions, and I learned a bit of Gaelic. My daughters learned Gaelic in the school because it was Gaelic, and I found Gaelic most fascinating. The roots of the language show you where it's like I can read a Gaelic dictionary. My Gaelic isn't good, not like fluent like my daughter's, but it shows you things that you never saw before. Now, it's like the word witchcraft or enchantment in Gaelic is bhuishach. Now, bhuia is yellow. So bhuishach is the art of yellowness. Enchantment is yellowness. It all has a sort of a special code, and gradually as I sort of discovered things, you would find that certain people would say things. It's like, for instance, in Gaelic, you have a word for church, it's not used. The word they actually use for church is naclachan, at the stones. Yeah? It's just things like that that show you where the roots... There is a word, there's an imported word for church that's something... it's like a bit like I've forgotten it. It's a bit like French église. It's derived from that. It's not used. It's an official word. They don't use it. They use naclachan at the stones. So it's like if you said, "Have you been to church today?" They'd say, "Have you been at the stones today?" Yeah. And It's things like that that give you an insight into the way that people's mind thinks and how, yes, it may have passed down, but it's like you wouldn't know unless you were up there that they had that this word they use for church is just that's just a dictionary word, you know, we don't use that. You know, this is the word we use. And it's like that with a lot of things. You realise colours have... Virtually every colour, major colour, has a different meaning that is a sort of a subtle and implied meaning. The thing about Gaelic is Gaelic is never simple. There's never this word means that word and that's all there is to it. Why Celtic peoples have such an art of poetry is because every word has at least two or three meanings and some of them hidden. It's like if you want the word for secretary. Yeah. The word for secretary is runeru. A person who writes runes. Now, as a pagan, this is so fascinating. You know? It's a whole detective story on its own. And then you add to this the folklore and the history and the sort of all the other stuff, and about the Picts, who are very strange people, and their art. I did a whole load of stuff in my art course, which was to do with the Picts, and I wrote sort of a thesis thing about ancient carved stones, you know, from sort of like cup and ring markings through... sort of like Neolithic things, right through to sort of like medieval carvings in churches, some of which are very enigmatic also. And it was well received. I got pretty high marks for it because it was like a topic they hadn't really dealt with very much. It was like, yeah, well, you're meant to do something original, and this was original. And... it was also expressing an interest of mine, and also tied in with the sort of personal quest that I was doing at the time, involved with the, you know, my artwork and my writing also expressed parts of my belief system. The thing is, I can't say when I ever became a pagan, because it's been a constant process throughout my life. I guess I was brought up with a fairly sort of pagan standards as a kid, and I just can, because of what happened when I was 13 with the doctrine of the original sin and the all this stuff, that just spurred me on into a search. I'm still searching for truths in words, in legends, in experiences I find with particular patches of earth. I still have psychic experiences. It's part of the way I am. I accept it perfectly. I regard normal people, if you've got normal people, as being sort of like just missing a few senses. You know, they can't be helped. They're just deficient, poor lambs. And, you know, when you look at the sort of normal attributes of maybe psychology and things like that, well, they're just not quite getting the full picture. You know, because there is so much outside of what is known. And it's like in the 50s, people used to believe that science had all the answers. And Steve has said to me that real scientists are people who know they've not got all the answers, and know that the more discoveries we have, the more questions it will raise. And that we may never know all the answers, but that doesn't stop us being on a permanent quest for knowledge, a permanent quest for, if you like, the religion of our ancestors. And I try to practice this in ritual as best I can. And I have written a lot of rituals, I've done those with lots of people, and just by myself. I do rituals out of door, rituals in the front room. I even do rituals on the bus. Quiet ones, people don't notice me doing. I can mentally do them, or I can use tools, or whatever. But my form of practice to whatever is going on around me. Is there anything you want me to tell you about, Tom?
What were pagan standards that you said you were brought up with? Pagan standards, and you said.
Well, largely, I was brought up with an open-mindedness. A lot of acceptance. I mean, when I was about four, I remember expressing great surprise that people were so worried about dying, because I said to my granny, I said, well, people come back, you know, they die and they come back and they get a new body. I was talking about reincarnation, but I didn't know the word reincarnation. And it's like my elderly relatives, sort of like my granny, my elderly relatives didn't say, oh, don't be so silly, child. They were, she knows something. It's like I was taught to read, you know, I used to read playing cards. I was taught to read playing cards at an early age. I do tarot now. My granny didn't read tarot. She just read on the playing cards. She'd keep them in her pocket. And people used to come round the back door and come and see her and say, well, you know, I've got some problems. And she'd get the playing cards out and sit at the table and make them a cup of tea and do them a quick reading. And she taught me when I was about 7. And she'd do tea leaves as well. And it was like part of the thing as I was growing up was that I accepted implicitly that my granny knew what she was doing, and that, you know, if you had problems, you'd get the cards out and you'd ask them and you'd do divination. I never questioned divination because it was part of my upbringing, you know. That's the kind of pagan standards I'm referring to, really. The fact that my uncle never said, don't be so silly, when I came up with the little girl, you know? And he looked, I mean, I was astonished that the swing wasn't there, because I've been swinging on the damn thing in the afternoon. And I didn't get sort of, you know, most parents would say, oh, don't be so silly. My uncle's attitude were, well, well, there are more things in heaven and earth than we know about, or even than we're allowed to know about. And it was a lot of the people that I associated with had a lot that, you know, don't be so silly, you need to go and see a psychiatrist. Because a lot of the people that, and even many of the people, the old people and the people I knew up in Scotland, I was a little bit guarded with them some of the time, but you can just get them off talking to you, and you get to know them, and they'll be quite happy. They'll talk to you. I mean, they believe in, you know, here are people who have believed in fairies all their lives, and they don't doubt fairies. They won't describe to you what fairies are, but they will, if you know, they don't question belief in spirits of, you know, spirits of the woods are fine. You know, we know spirits of the woods. They don't question these things. So along the way, I've been with a lot of people who've, yeah, I mean, I've had people who've sort of questioned, but I tend to avoid those. Because I know instinctively that to be open-minded is better than to be closed-minded, because, and also, I never believed in the everything can either be right or wrong. I always believed that there are multiple truths, so that it may be that something is like derived from so and so, but equally, if there's a folk legend, that may equally have something to do with it. There may not be just ever one simple answer. There may be two or three answers that have something to do with the thing. You know, kind of, no, in this sort of like, in a place. So, oh, well, that just comes from the fact that it's Helen's Well, you know. Mm. Well, maybe it's not as simple as that. Maybe, also, Somerset is a very strange place, because the street where I lived in, they used to put up, on Oak Apple Day, which I can't remember what day it is, but I'm sure you can find out. They used, a particular house used to put an oak branch with acorns on outside their door. Certain houses in the road, and some of these houses went back to Stuart times, you know, they were sort of like had dogs with ruffs on them and pineapples on the door and things. And many of them were old cottages, you know, thatched cottages. And certain of these houses used to put the oak things out on the day that was supposed to be the celebration of when King Charles II got crowned again, because he hid in an oak apple, in an oak tree. And yet, I'm wondering, does that not go back to possibly Druidic things to do with oaks? And local historians will tell you categorically no. No, no, it dates from then, it was never done before that. But how do you know? How can you be totally sure? You know, it's like, I believe that both could be true. They may have revived an old Druidic custom at that time, but it was there before that. You know, people have said, well, the Victorians invented maypole dancing. I don't believe that. So I've checked through legends in Germany where people dance around live trees. Now, if at one time we were Saxon in this country, yet maybe the Victorians developed prissy maypole dancing with kids, with special maypoles and little ribbons. But I think, I mean, if you look at Celtic gods and goddesses, you know there's a god called a Bele, sure, related to Belenus, who's supposed to be a sun god, but wasn't. That Victorian obsession with sun gods. But every god had to be a sun god, sun was so important. But if you look at Vile, it's actually, the word is actually part of a word meaning tree. So if you get, as difficult, it doesn't sound right, but the word Fivliu, the V changes to a V. VH in Gaelic is a V sound. It's just strange rules of lineage. It's where it's like in German where you put umlauts over things.
Ah, right.
Yeah. It's a change in sound when you have certain combinations. Mm. So five U is a beech tree. So the Wille section, if you have sort of like a cherry tree or a plum tree, as it's one word in Gaelic, but the Wille, which is not now a word for tree, is the second element of the word that means tree. Therefore, to me, Wille, who was actually the consort of Danu, actually was originally a tree god. So if you've actually got a tree god, you're actually looking at, you know, whatever his position in life, he was a tree god. I mean, what's a green man? Yeah, okay, medieval thing to do with the Christian church. Yeah, but if you had tree gods before that, isn't there maybe some connection? It's like the Northern Irish have this thing about King Billy, and yet they were calling King William, and that was his name. It's all referred to as King Billy. Billy was a particular god with reference to Ulster in ancient times, and I think the King Billy thing is a memory of it. They don't know it, but they're just actually, it's to do with the god that the Gauls referred to as Vilenus, who's, oh, he's not a tree god, he's a sun god. That's because they didn't understand. Half of the Victorians who laid the foundations of what mythology is all about didn't even understand Gaelic. So you've got a god with a name that's called Tree, and saying, he's a sun god. You know, this makes real linguistic sense. So, you know, this is sort of, where was I up to with that one? So I believe that if you have a tree god, you know, what do? You dance around the tree. I mean, Christmas trees are part of the pagan Germanic tradition. They are absolutely nothing to do with Christ and the birth of Christ, because they don't get living coniferous trees in the Holy Land, and let's face it. And so isn't this part of tree worship? Dancing around trees? Wassailing apple trees? This is all part of tree worship. So why can't all this lot tie in? I don't believe that the Victorians invented maypole dancing. I think is, you know, I think it's a silly. And of course, if that happened, nothing else can be true. I think many truths are possible. Many things influence things more than we think. So I guess I think I'm what you call a lateral thinker. My granny did bring me up to be a lateral thinker deliberately. And also, I'm a bookworm too. I've always been a bookworm. I was actually reading newspapers by the age of four. I could read simple books and things by the age of about, letters and things by about two. I learned to read before school. And I also had the problem that I didn't associate with other kids and things. I think this is part of it. Partly due to my upbringing, partly due to just the way I am. I prefer the company of old people. They were more interesting. Kids are boring. Well, kids haven't got a lot to tell you about life. You know, you've got an old mate who's 80-something. She can tell you all about the First World War. You know, the Second World War. She can tell you about, you know, all sorts of things about, you know, history and when the first water pipe was put in on the corner of the street and, you know, you know, kids can't tell you much because they don't know much. So, you know, if you're a seeker after knowledge, old people are going to be more interesting. And, this was, I think that's probably what I'd think about anyway. It's probably just lateral thinking. But being taught to lateral think, never be, my granny also taught me not to accept things at face value. She always said, behind everything there's reasons, and there's reasons hidden beneath the reasons, and it's your job to find them out if you can. And We used to have very, very heavily intellectual conversations, me and my granny, even as a young child. Because if I asked her why, she'd not only tell me why, but she'd tell me all the other ins and outs about it she knew. So, I think, and she was a very forward-looking woman, and she's been hanging around me a lot, actually. We keep seeing her in the back of the car at the moment. She's around all the time. You've seen her.
Yeah?
Yeah. You can tell it's her because she's a good foot taller than me. We look very alike. I know you missed the step because you mistook her. She had a spot here, and she's not always around me. It's just at the moment she's around me a lot of the time. She's sort of moved in on me a bit recently, hasn't she? Possibly because I'm not keeping too well.
Well, you said you do rituals on the bus, and you do rituals. Where did you learn to do those rituals? I mean, how do you structure them?
How
did you learn to structure them?
Well, in the first instance, I started doing ritual almost unconsciously. When I was in Scotland, I used to have this little hill, which is... Well, I was told by Duncan that it was an ancient church, and I said, well, there's never been a church there. And he said, well, no, it's a church before churches were. And, in other words, a sort of a standing, a little hill with a little bump, with a sort of, had a few standing stones and things on it. I used to go up there at dawn and at dusk and just talk. Just no one around to hear me. I just used to be there, experience the peace, and I gradually began to talk to the earth, to the sky, to just say what I wanted to say. And I learned things more about stuff, and I began to incorporate some little Celtic prayers and things. And when I came down to Leeds, I wanted to participate with others, so I sort of learned. I met a few people who were involved with the failing scene in Leeds, and they were practicing Wicca, so I practiced Wicca. Sometimes I use Wicca for a basis for what I do, sometimes I don't. A lot of time it just comes out of my head. I use certain Celtic formulae. I've got things like I've got things like the Carmina Gadelica. You know what Carmina Gadelica is? The Carmina Gadelica is a collection of writings by a guy called Alexander Carmichael, collected from people in the north of Scotland in Gaelic. They're verses and sort of prayers, incantations, some of which are very Christian, many of which are very pagan. And to be perfectly truthful, some of them have a different meaning in the Gaelic than what has been translated to be in the English. And there are things like, have you ever come across a thing called the genealogy of Breed? It's a thing you repeat for protection every day and every night. I can't remember it off my heart. It's very long. Sort of like, let the protection of Breed be upon me and over me, let it protect me from dart of fairy, of fae, of arrow, let I not, it's got part of it is, let me not be killed by drowning, by strangling, and by fire, let not the black sleep lie upon me, protect from, give me protection from the evil eye. It's a huge, long thing. It's known in many parts of Scotland, slightly different forms. And it's parts of it I use. These are like sort of prayers of protection to read. And the format with the sort of like death by drowning, death by strangling, death by fire, these actually probably, they've been researched by people like Anne Ross, and they possibly point to a definite pre-Christian origin because of the way things are always mentioned in threes. Mm. And in some places you've got things where where sort of like Christian saints have been substituted for other people, and Michael, for instance, is quite often substituted for Lou. But it's a code, and everyone knows it's a code. And then you've got sort of things like the things I said people were saying about the sowing of the seed and the blessing of the first Vanak and the sort of like charm against the loads and loads of charms against the evil eye and cure for milkless cows and stuff like this. And it was all collected together in the Victorian period in Gaelic by a guy who's a customs officer who travelled the country. Yeah, but customs officers were used to, you know, the whiskey distilling and things like that. And they were there, and it was like, well, you compromise with the people and you do things and you get a wee bit out of them. And if you don't compromise with the talk, you just never find out where they're making it anyhow. But in the course of his travels around to collect dues and customs, he was in contact with a lot of very country people in unremote islands, and he transcripted all these sort of ancient prayers and invocations as faithfully as he could. Some in repeated versions that vary from area to area. And I do use these kind of things a lot. And I did use, as I found out about them, I started to use some of these elements, and also in my rituals, because they're traditional elements within the Gaelic culture, as far as we know. And some of them use the same pattern, and you use it and you write upon that element. But otherwise, I tend to do things just how they come out, because when you've been doing it a bit, you can start to do it as it's just like it permeates into you, and you begin to know the wording and the form. These things have wording and formula, and you just use that wording and formula and create it into a ritual. It's like you'll have heard the blessings, like the one where you'll have heard the blessings where, like, the one where it's within me, without me, to my left and to my right. It's that kind of formula. That's where it comes from. That comes from the Carmina Gadelica. Yeah, these are ancient things written down orally from quite often illiterate Gaelic people in the Victorian period, and they're the best we've got. They ain't perfect, but they're all we've got, and they're relics of an earlier age, and as such they're the religion of our ancestors, to be used in ritual purposes. And I mean, I've done things in ritual where sometimes I'm working with people who use a Wiccan formula, I'll use a Wiccan formula. But
how did you meet the people in?
Well,
you went down.
You mean how did I come down to Lisbeth, or how did I?
Well, what brought you down to Lisbeth in the first place?
Well, there were some people who were up in university who were doing tree planting up in the village I was in Scotland. I met them and I came down to Lisbeth to visit, and my first husband died of a brain tumour, and it was very difficult getting up there without being able to drive, and with teenage kids who needed a broader aspect on life. So it was just a personal decision about that I wanted to be somewhere. I also had a fancy to do some education myself, you know, because it's pretty hard living up in the hills with a pack of teenage girls who really need more than the Highlands can offer them. And it's unfortunate, but it is the way of things that when you get to a certain age, you need college and work and a broader aspect on life than a remote village in the, well, 2 miles out of a remote village in the Highlands can actually give you, you know. And I felt it was important for the girls to use that point to actually get out of there and hit civilization again. And I got in touch with the Moot through the then now defunct sort of Northern. I found out about the Northern. One of the girls who was up, who I stayed with, stayed in, and she knew of the Northern Earth, the Earth Mysteries group. And one or two of the people were actually told me about Moot, and they were people who went. And that's what when I sort of got involved in sort of Moot. I'd never been to Moot before. I'd been involved in the village where we were with a. It's a lot of. Scotland is a bit depopulated. You know, the Highland clearances and all this sort of stuff. But even then, it's very hard to live up there economically. And at the time when there was a lot of oil-related work, a lot of people came from south and they bought properties up there and lived a bit as hippies and had the few goats and sheep and brought the children up there. And our village was very much a sort of dying village, if you like, that had been repopulated by folk singing hippies who made their money working on the oil rigs. And so we had a sort of an alternative community which was involved in the folk music scene, which the folk music pagan scene in general. I'd worked with people who had before then. They weren't traditional druid brothers, no, they were just sort of like people who, well, basically used things from the village, used the folk tales, and sort of had a belief in ancient Celtic gods and goddesses, and were trying to the best of their ability the religion of their ancestors in any way which they knew best, you know. I mean, nobody can say whose is the right way to do anything, and I guess their way is as good as anyone else. And that's when I first started to do it, with both on myself instinctively first of all, and then with the guidance from other people in the village. And of course I'm very interested in folk music and folk rap, old songs and old tunes. There's a lot of tradition stuff involved with folk music, you know, like Green Grow the Rushes Oh and that stuff. But in Scottish stuff you get a lot of hymns. These were people who studied the traditional songs and the poems and incantations, because many of them are put in song too, and you know, they're walking songs for walking the cloth, and they're strictly a female province. All these elements have sort of come to make me the hefty little opinionated Celtic pagan I am today, I guess.
What keeps you going to the Moot?
Because I know I can. One, paganism, whether it privately or publicly, where many people who go to Moots now or used to go to Moots, most are pagan. Not all, but most of them are pagan friendly. I do it for life. I also do it because I like the constant challenge of talking to new people. I mean, at any given spot, I've always got two or three people that phone me, that talk to me, that email me problems. How shall I do a ritual for this? And I'm sort of like your agony on the email or the phone, you know, to sort of. But I don't mind doing this, you know. I'm in it as much to help other people learn. I don't teach. I don't sort of, like, say, teach anyone formally. I'll be your agony aunt on the other end of the phone if you've got problems. But I'm not a formal teacher. I don't want to be a formal. My health doesn't permit me to be a formal teacher. But exchanging views with people, because I don't want to grow stale. I'm constantly growing. If I cease to grow, cease to develop, it becomes a game. I don't want that to ever happen. There for my amusement, there, and to other people. Other people also may have ideas that rub off on me and make me rethink, because I've constantly rethink my world. What I'm telling you today, you know, in 10 years' time, I might have, well, I've changed really. I'll have just moved on. So what I'm saying is important today, it may be sometime in the future there may be more stuff that's important. That, you know, I'll have moved on from this, because you know, researching more things. And I mean, I've got half a book computer up there. One day it's going to come out. And my ambition is that if I were to acquire my attitude sets, I was once told that by an assistant in Waterstones that people today, one of the most nicked books from Waterstones is The White Goddess. Now, it was published in 1947. Now, if I could achieve a book that was most nicked by students from Waterstones 50 years after its publication, I'd be well chuffed. I mean, on the other side, but I'd be well chuffed, you know? I'd say, yeah, that's what I want. And the reason why is because The White Goddess was such a challenging book. It questioned so much about our perception of, yeah, okay, so he published his poetry, he did write it later on, but it was an inspired book. It was inspired writing. Yes, yeah, some of the things he came, conclusions he came to, wrong. But it's a treatise on starting you out to think. And if I can write a book which makes people think, challenge people's preconceptions about some of the aspects of Celtic paganism, some of the aspects of history. Yeah, I want to rewrite history, because history is written a certain way. That's how the political expedient, the time, seen it fit to do. All the things that they're discovering, I mean, 100 years ago, that Stonehenge was supposed to have been built by the Anglos. You know, the foundations on which our history, and a particular ancient history and archaeology are built, are comparatively rocky, because they were done by class Victorian gentlemen who didn't really know what they were on about. Today we've got a lot more tools, and yet we're still finding that things go back further than we ever thought possible. That our ancient civilizations had more depth, more knowledge than we ever thought possible. And in some sense, I believe we're actually coming out of the ages of Christianity. Yeah. And I think in many senses, I may not be healthy and well, but if I produce art that expresses something, if I can produce books that make people think, and I can help other people to come to terms with their view of paganism, because I ain't imposing mine. I'm only going to give people at most a bit of food to chew on, because I'm never going to say, well, my way is the right way, because I'd be wrong. Or I could be mistaken, just like I think today that Grant was mistaken about a few things, but I think he was very rude in many ways. He made a slip-ups. I'm going to make a few slip-ups. But what I want to give people a food to chew on, and if that's my life in being here in this lifetime, you know, well, that's what it is. I'm physically being prevented from, so that I can actually get on with the move from to here, is because I was living in the city and I was getting people coming round to time saying, can you do me a ritual to get a boyfriend? I'm in this real world, this house I'm in, you know, can you get me a ritual? You know, and I was literally spending all my energy trying to teach people, and I moved out and to get away from my kids. And don't believe when people say, stop doing things when you're, you know, my kids are 26, 24, and I've got two grandchildren, and they are still Mum, can you do us a favour? Can you keep, can you move, can you host tomorrow? I've got to move. Can you keep your bed for us? You know, I'm a little distance, very far. Two of my girls are in the backs now, and I've got one, she's just in. So, and my grandchildren, you know, they're not very. Also, that people were sort of like being a wee bit too demanding on me because my health is demanding. And I felt that it was time to sort of move somewhere quiet. Here is quiet. Yeah, it's a little sad. There's a great big huge park just out there. It's handy to shop, transport. It's a peaceful place. A peaceful place for study, paint, do art, do textile work, and I'm planning to get back despite my health. All my life is always tied in together. My pagan beliefs form my writing, my artwork, all of it. Just I have this interest. All interests are merged. Read about is what I mostly, it's to do with what I believe the most important thing in my life. It's like I mean friends and sat up nights, many nights before we actually got together.
Struggling not to solve.
Yeah.
You're doing well.
Yeah.
You're next.
It's really difficult.
Like, I would not have considered ever having a relationship who wasn't a pagan. Because it's so important that it would be like a musician trying to have a relationship with someone who's like music. Yeah. Your art is your life. You want to have to share your life and interest rather than someone who we have discussions. We've relationship long before it was fizzing, sitting up chewing the fat and drinking tea all night, and we still do it. It's what our relationship's about. It's a normal relationship, it's a physical relationship, and it has aspects and certain. Also, we've grown in other things because I've interested you because of my health, and he's sort of like. All that is sort of, I don't see it as being, most of it is connected somewhere along the line, you know. And I believe that I believe that everything that I do is sort of connected through my belief. I wouldn't have considered having a relationship with a non-pagan. I mean, my beliefs aren't exactly like mine. Changed mine, well, subtly in for a degree. He's more into sort of like northern tradition, being shoved toward northern tradition a bit at the moment. Fine. You know, I mean, in Scotland there is a mixed Celtic tradition, northern tradition, pre-Celtic tradition. I'm not really into sort of Egyptian tradition and stuff like that. I'll read about it, but it's not my bag of fish. Very much involved in what is essentially British paganism. The traditions of Albion. I believe they're relics of religious traditions that have been lost. That's just part of my. Care about that is something I've got yet to do, want to do. Because I know that these aren't just, there's something behind them. They go back further to the traditions behind the Arthurian stories. The names have been changed and some people have altered so you can start playing through it. And there's a lot of meat that I have a go at. And if you like me to produce a book, as I've said to you, and continue being open to new. all my life, like my grandmother, because she was open to nudism until even then. And I went, my granny moved down with us to the west of Shorewell towards the end of her life. And she said that I want to go home, go around, I want to see all my friends, my relatives before I go. Are you coming with me? And I said, you know, you're not going to die, you're perfect. Well, it's okay, as you ever have been. And she said to me, she said, I am going and see all my friends and relatives before I die. And he said, of course I'll come with you. All the relatives. And the night we went to a golden wedding party, which you've seen years. You know, golden, an old couple, lots of chance. Years and years, late time, and she talked, and she laughed. And then the following morning, my great aunt, she wasn't feeling, saw her. It's like, she just wasn't really quite. And she, in a matter of 2 or 3 hours, she just passed away. Me and the Alison said, she had a good time last night, she's been round there, she wanted to see. And she passed on. And that was what she'd said. And then I had to cope with my mother, because my mother, of course, being the child she was, she hadn't believed that's what she was going to do, and she did it. And at the end of the day, that's how she went out, you know. And out she... My family have a good time at funerals, aren't you? Yeah. Because, and it's like, well...
Sadness.
It's a sadness, but the people wouldn't want you to be that sad, because most of them, either were going, they'd go around, see the... And they'd die the day after they'd seen the last of the people. They usually have been out drink the night before, and they'd die. The mother died when she was gardening. Most of my family die in a way that you can't miss. You know, most people die in hospital. No, my family don't. My family die at home in the bed, or if not at home in the bed, they're in the bed, the daughter's house bed. You know, they don't do this. And that's because they're going. And which is why I know I'm here for a good few years to come. My turn. But then, that this gift? I don't know. I don't know at all. But it seems to apply to them all. Any more questions you want?
No, I think that's great.